Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to China Corner Office, a podcast produced in partnership with SubChina, featuring conversations with business leaders from around the world about the challenges and opportunities of doing business in China, the world's most dynamic economy. I'm Chris Marquis, a professor of business at Cornell, where I teach and research on this same topic. Every episode, we talk to an executive at a company doing business in China and explore what has led to their personal and business success, and also some of the challenges they've encountered along the way. With geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and China on the rise, understanding how business can compete in China is more important than ever. If you're interested in doing business in China or are looking for insights to adjust your current business strategy, this is the show for you. Thanks for tuning in. Today, we're talking to Derek Sandals, Director of Baijiu Education and Communication for Ming River Sichuan Baijiu, a company who is working to introduce the famous Chinese spirit Baijiu to U.S. consumers. Derek is also the author of the first English language books about Baijiu, Baijiu, The Essential Guide for Chinese Spirits, and Drunk in China, Baijiu and the World's Oldest Drinking Culture. The latter, I must say, I read recently and can heartily recommend. It weaves together his Derek's personal story living in China during a really interesting period, and also has a lot of great insights and background on Chinese culture, history, particularly how they vary regionally. So, you know, even if you're not interested in Baijiu, I recommend you picking it up. It's a really interesting read for those of us who are interested in China. So, Derek, welcome to China Corner Office.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So the first question, which, you know, maybe some of our listeners might have as well. So why Baijiu? You know, my experience is that most Westerners find it to be like firewater, don't like it, you know, get stuck having these little sips of it and grimace afterwards. And so I'm curious, you know, what attracted you to the spirit? And did you like it from the first time you tried it, or was it an acquired taste?
It was definitely an acquired taste. And I think my early experiences with Baijiu have a lot to do with why I decided that I wanted to learn more about it. Because, you know, for someone like me who comes from America, you've traveled, you know, thousands of miles to live in China. You're out there and you're in a situation where the social life of China and the business, the holidays, the celebration, even like weddings and funerals, everything involves drinking there, where people gather around a dinner table, like spread with many different dishes, and usually there's a bottle of Baijiu in the center of that meal. And that's kind of the fuel for conversation that, you know, keeps the meal and the excitement level raising throughout the evening. So I had the same experience that a lot of foreigners have, where I had a few initial experiences with Baijiu where it didn't leave a very good impression. I didn't understand what I was drinking. I didn't understand why it was so strong or why it had such unusual flavors. And I really didn't understand why the Chinese people I was drinking with were essentially like forcing it down my throat for most of the meal. So it was confusing in every way to me as an outsider to this culture, but I knew how important it was, both in the world of spirits, that it was the most popular drink in the world because so many people drink it in China. And I knew that it was incredibly important culturally to everything. So, I knew that so long as I stayed where I was in my comfort zone and didn't drink much baijiu, I was going to be missing out on a very large portion of what was going on around me. And, you know, like, why wouldn't I try to better understand it if the result of that would be having access to a much larger portion of China than I had before?
Yeah, really interesting. And I, you know, give you a lot of credit. I mean, I, you know, I've developed a liking for baijiu myself. I mean, it's, you know, over the years, like you're saying, sort of going to many of these banquets, and it's just so fun. I mean, to, you know, toast people, and, you know, people are getting up, walking around the room. And so, you know, I mean, I think it really, you know, makes sense to embrace it. I'm curious though, I'm not sure everyone, though, ends up actually liking it or really appreciating sort of the variations in the flavors. Can you say a little bit about how you actually went from sort of your first experiences, which, you know, maybe, you know, you didn't understand it or thought it tasted horribly? I know that was sort of my experience, to really coming to an appreciation of it.
Yeah, well, I think one of the big, you know, stumbling blocks for a lot of people is that they have an early negative experience with baijiu, and they assume that that is somehow representative of the whole of what baijiu is and what it can be. Whereas very few people outside of China, and even very few people within China, like, have a sense for just, like, what baijiu is at, like, the most basic level. You'll often see major news outlets describe baijiu with a parenthetical, like, Chinese rice wine or something like that, when almost none of baijiu is made from rice. And
right.
It's not a wine. It's a distilled spirit, hence the strength. And it's not just one distilled spirit. It's many distilled spirits. It's an entire family of drinks. So at present, they have about 12 different distilled spirits that are traditionally produced in China, and each one of them is called baijiu, but they're very different things. So just learning that in the first, you know, couple weeks of researching baijiu, learning that there are different things called baijiu, is a really eye-opening experience, because once you know that that it's not just one thing, you can go to a liquor store and buy five different spirits. All of them are called baijiu. They have different, like, category names underneath that. But and then taste them side by side and realize, like, wait, no, it's not the thing that I didn't like. It's a few different things, and some of them maybe I don't like, but many of them I do. And then it just becomes a process of trial and error experimentation until you discover the drink what you like. And what I've found in now about a decade of introducing lots and lots of people to baijiu for the first time and giving them samples of different styles of baijiu is it's very, very rare that you taste people on all of the most popular styles of baijiu and they come away saying, I hate all of this. Generally, people like at least half of the baijiu's I serve them. And it's not uncommon when I'm working with people in the alcohol industry that they'll like all of the different baijiu's I serve to them. So it really is something that, because there's so little known about it and it's so poorly understood around the world, it's a situation in which once you get over those basic educational hurdles, you can really make a lot of headway. And a lot of people discover that baijiu isn't at all what they thought it was, and that there is redeeming value. That's not the case for everyone with all baijiu's, but I'd say more often than not, I've been able to convince even the most ardent Baijiu skeptics that there's at least one Baijiu out there that they would enjoy drinking.
Cool. I'd love to dig in a little bit with, about some of these different types. So it's sort of like, you know, whiskey, and there's mm-hmm. like scotch or bourbon or, you know, maybe Irish whiskey, you know, sort of under this category, I guess. I mean, so this bit larger category of Baijiu. Can you describe what some of the key differences among the different types are? I mean, I don't think we need to go into all 12, but
right.
But thinking like, you know, Maotai is a famous one. Wulang Ye is another famous one. You know, maybe some of the more famous ones, like what, you know, what differentiates them from some of the others?
Sure. So yeah, usually I don't go into all 12 different styles because 8 of the 12 tend to be fairly obscure and are only made by, you know, one or two different distilleries. Whereas 4 make up the overwhelming majority of the entire market. And those are, you know, rice aroma Baijiu, which comes from southeastern China, light aroma Baijiu, which comes from northeastern China. And then you have strong aroma and sauce aroma Baijiu, which come from southwestern China, from Sichuan and Guizhou, respectively. And these four styles of Baijiu are very different drinks. So rice aroma, as the name suggests, is made from rice, whereas the other three categories are primarily made from sorghum, which is a tall, stocky plant that's kind of similar to corn. And rice aroma Baijiu, it tends to be very like mild and pretty easy to drink. I'd say it's most similar to like a vodka or a soju in terms of its texture and flavor profile. You can definitely taste a little bit of rice in there, so maybe like some sake notes as well. And then up in northeastern China, light aroma Baijiu is best known for like Red Star Arguoto is one of the best known light aroma Baijiu brands. And that tends to be very like dry and crisp. It's often bottled at very high proofs. The cheap stuff tends to be, you know, a little tough to drink.
That's, you know, that's my first experience is actually with that. And it's funny that it's like called light aroma because it seems like the harshest in some way of them. I don't know if that's the case, but I took some students. You've probably been to this Niulanshan.
Niulanshan,
by Beijing. And so we went there as a student class visit, and it was quite fun. I mean, you could smell the Baijiu throughout the city, the small city that it's in, but it's that's can be a pretty harsh type, the Arguoto.
Yeah, so there's two like primary styles of light aroma Baijiu. There's like the what's called Fenzhou, which comes from like Shanxi province, named after like Fenyang County. And there's Arguoto, which is the style that comes from Beijing that tends to be a little bit, you know, more mass market and a bit rougher on the drinker, I would say. But the light aroma in light aroma and the aroma in all of these refers to like the literal Chinese like name for the different categories of Baijiu, which is like by their aroma types or like Xiangxing. So it's not a perfect descriptor, and it's really referring specifically to like the complexity of the flavor. Whereas strong aroma Baijiu, that comes out of Sichuan. It's the most popular style of Baijiu in China. A lot of the well-known distilleries, you know, like you mentioned, Wuliang Ye, Luzhou Laojiao, Shui Jingfang, Jiannan Chen, Yanghe, these are all strong aroma Baijiu's. And strong aroma Baijiu tends to be the most popular style of Baijiu by a significant margin. And it's notable for having both like very fruity flavors, particularly like tropical fruit, pineapple-y, a little bit of like mango, guava, that banana. And then you have sauce aroma right across the border in Guizhou province, which is Guizhou Maotai is the best known right. distillery in this category. And it tends to be very, very savory and focus on more umami flavors. It's got lots of like sesame and nuts and herbs and a whole lot less of the fruitiness that you associate with strong aroma Baijiu. So each one of these drinks, if you taste them side by side, you wouldn't recognize them as being the same drink. But Unfortunately, because of the name Baijiu, which is, you know, is literally like a Chinese stand-in for liquor, it means white alcohol, has kind of come to define everything that China makes, and a lot of confusion has ensued.
Interesting. That, you know, that sort of brings us to, you know, introducing it to the American market. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, when you introduce these different types, people always find some that you like. And I know Ming River, I think, is the strong aroma type. So is that the kind that mostly appeals to Westerners? I'm interested when you have these different tastings, like what are some of the trends that you see among Western palates with their Baijiu interests?
Yeah, well, we entered the process of trying to introduce people outside of China to Baijiu with the hypothesis that rice aroma Baijiu would be the logical starting point, because rice aroma Baijiu tends to be bottled at lower strengths. In China, it's often possible to see it at like 30-40% alcohol by volume, whereas a lot of strong and sauce are bottled around like 52% alcohol by volume. So we thought this is a lot like vodka. It's not got very aggressive flavors. It's not very strong. So let's try this out and see what people say. And the early results were not bad on the flavor component. Like a lot of people tried it and said like, yeah, this is fine. I would drink this. There's nothing wrong with this. It's a perfectly fine drink. But they also noted that it's not very unusual. It doesn't have a lot to recommend it over vodka or soju or any one of the drinks that is widely available outside of China and usually costs quite a bit less than a product that's going to be, you know, imported from China would cost on the market. So like when we were talking to bartenders, they said like, yeah, I would work with this, but I don't see any reason why I would use this instead of vodka when I can get vodka for much cheaper. So then we kind of went back to the drawing board, and by we, I mean my team at Ming River, me and my partners, Matthias Hager, Bill Eisler, and at that time, Simon Dong, though he's since moved on. We decided that we would work with strong aroma because it was our personal flavor that we identified with the most. And it was also, because it is the most popular style of Baijiu in China, it felt fairly representative of the category. And what I've found since then is that when I do taste tests, particularly with people in the spirits industry, like people who work at bars, restaurants, you know, or it, you know, selling other types of spirits, that they find that to be their most, the one that they like the best. Sauce aroma is also quite popular in these taste tests. Not necessarily because it's the easiest Baijiu to immediately appreciate, or definitely not the easiest Baijiu to work with in a cocktail, but because it is something so unlike anything else that they have at their bar that they're working with. Strong aroma Baijiu has another pretty significant advantage in the international market, which is that because it has this really like bright, fruity, sweet flavor, it is quite a bit similar in a cocktail to like a very like strong, like pot distilled Jamaican rum or like a rum agricole from Martinique. So it's similar to certain ingredients that bartenders have some comfort with, but it's also different enough. It's got those like umami, those earthy, cheesy, funky notes that really bring something completely different to the table. So we've had a lot of success with that, whereas light aroma is kind of the odd man out most of the time. It's not the style that most people respond most positively to. And I think that's because light aroma, in terms of what it tastes like in the world of spirits, is probably closest to like a grappa, the like Italian pomace brandy, which is not a drink that's like widely popular outside of parts of Europe. So It's probably got the least overlap in particularly American tastes.
Oh, that's really interesting. And I would actually, as it turns out, after having gone to Chengdu, I mean, a lot of time I spend in China is in Chengdu. And so many of the people that I'm with, they're big fans of the strong aroma. And so I've naturally gravitated to actually liking that the best myself. But I always thought it would be something that wouldn't actually fit American taste that well. But it's interesting to hear what you're saying, that in the taste tests, actually a lot of sort of bartenders end up liking it. And I think, you know, the idea of sort of leaning into both some of the uniqueness and then also the fact that it overlaps a little bit with some of the rums, so you can be made into cocktails. I think, yeah, really, really interesting. So can you take us back? So you have this interest in bringing Baijiu to the U.S., and you know, you mentioned your partners in Ming River. Can you say a little bit about the founding of Ming River? You know, how you got it up and running. It is, based out of the U.S., but also I think has a strong Sichuan connection as well.
There's a very strong Sichuan connection. So like you, strong aroma Baijiu quickly became my favorite style of Baijiu. And largely that happened in 2 years between 2011 and 2013 when I lived in Chengdu. And strong aroma Baijiu was widely available. There were dozens of different brands on my local convenience store steps, and it just pairs great with the spicy food out in Sichuan. So that became my favorite right away. But how this came about was, like I said, I, in my time in China, decided at a certain point that I wanted to know more about Baijiu. And when I was living in Chengdu, I'd lived in Shanghai for 5 years before that and gotten into, you know, writing about Chinese history while I was working at a publishing house, Earnshaw Books, in Shanghai. It wasn't until Chengdu that I really decided to explore this and read everything I could get my hands on, kind of taught myself whatever I could from English language sources, and then later like Chinese textbooks on alcohol, and ended up taking a trip of a few months around the country, visiting different, both contemporary and historic production regions of alcohol in China, so that I could, you know, hear it directly from the people who made it, you know, what they were trying to do, what they liked about it, and hopefully get a sense of like what this universe was and where Chengdu and my experiences fit into that. So I ended up publishing a book about Baijiu, The Essential Guide to Chinese Spirits in 2014. And I was traveling around that year to Chinese cities, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beijing, Chengdu, and speaking about Baijiu and Chinese drinking culture. And after my talks, I would bring a few bottles with me, and I would let the audience taste a few of the different styles of Baijiu, so they could get a sense for, you know, what I thought were good Baijiu's, and they could see maybe it wasn't what they thought it was when they stepped in the door. And during one of these tastings, an American came up to me, Bill Eisler, and he was working in like the cattle industry in Inner Mongolia, actually, at the time. But he had worked, running bars in Beijing in the past, and he had some friends who he was thinking of opening a bar with, and he'd asked me, you know, that had people liked Baijiu as much as they were enjoying it at this talk in Beijing and other cities. And I said, yeah. And he was saying that he hadn't known what the bar that they were opening, what their hook should be, what they should build their program around. And he was thinking maybe they should build a cocktail bar that was solely focused around drinks made with Baijiu. there they were in China, and there were many bars of all different kinds, but nothing where you could just sit and casually drink baijiu. In a country that makes, you know, literally, you know, billions of liters of baijiu every year. So he asked what I thought, and I thought it was kind of a crazy idea, but I didn't tell him that. I said, you know, sounds cool. Good luck. And I didn't really think a lot about it until a few months later when he reached out to me again and told me that they were going to be opening in a hutong in a couple of weeks. And just asked, you know, for my thoughts, and I was excited about it. But it was a real challenge because a lot of people doubted that this notion that a baijiu could work in a cocktail bar, because you have two potential customer bases in Beijing. You have local Beijingers who drink baijiu exclusively in restaurants, and you have the expatriate community who, like you and I, have largely initially bad opinions of baijiu and wouldn't think usually to order a drink that had baijiu in it. So the expectation was, you know, that this might not work, but when they opened up, they got a lot of people in there, I think, for the novelty of it. About three quarters were foreign expatriates, and one quarter was local Chinese. But within about a year of it being open, that was exactly flipped. It had become more popular with the locals and, you know, was still frequented by, you know, foreigners, tourists, people who wanted to try baijiu when they were in Beijing. But they were attracting particularly an unusual demographic for drinking baijiu, which tended to be both co-ed. Baijiu drinkers in China tend to be over the age of 35 and male. Not exclusively, but that's by far the largest demographic. And they tended to be younger than 35. So within a few months of their getting some press for opening a bar built around baijiu, Chinese distilleries started sending representatives to their bar to try to figure out what it was that they were doing different that was getting people who don't normally drink baijiu to drink baijiu, and asking if they would be willing to work with those distilleries to help them create products and strategies for attracting new consumer bases for baijiu. So at this point, they reached back out to me. I no longer lived in China at the time. I was in Argentina. And they said, you know, we've got these distilleries in China who think that there's an opportunity for baijiu outside of China. Would you, you know, team up with us and we could work to develop these programs for them? So I said, sure, because I was also getting business inquiries, both from Chinese and international business people, who were asking for my advice on baijiu. And I wasn't based in China, so having partners over there would be incredibly useful. But this consulting business we started, it only lasted maybe 2 or 3 months before a major strong aroma baijiu distillery, Luzhou Laojiao, reached out to us and said that they had actually been planning for a while to launch a product that would exclusively target the international market. Something that wouldn't be available in China, but would be, they saw as kind of like a, you know, a spearhead for baijiu outside of China, something that could raise global awareness and could get baijiu into the places that it wasn't at present, which was, you know, more international restaurants, bars, nightclubs, music venues, just all of the non-traditional baijiu consumption venues. So we said that we would be happy to work on that. They said, we don't want you, you know, consulting on this. We want you on the team. And so we worked out a deal where we would co-own the brand that we created with them and would take over as the kind of sales management team overseas, where we would oversee the creative direction of the project outside of China. And they would make the product in China and use their expertise to help us make the best possible baijiu for the international market.
Cool. Really, yeah, very interesting sort of founding story. I mean, from you as an author and giving talks and, you know, meeting up with some entrepreneurs, and obviously you were working, like you mentioned, the consulting side as well. You know, and I really want to get into, like, you know, the product creation, like how you're able to create Ming River. But before then, I want to go back a little bit to, you mentioned the bar that your partners had previously started as a cocktail bar with baijiu. And, you know, as I think about baijiu, I've never actually had a baijiu cocktail. You know, it's really tied up, you know, with these little small glasses that people, you know, if you respect the person, you'll do the whole shot, or maybe you just take a little sip. And, you know, as part of the Chinese drinking culture, and then the Western drinking culture is usually more, you know, mixed drinks, cocktails. And I'm curious, was there any sort of tradition or background of cocktail making with baijiu prior to your partners founding that?
Not so much. So the bar was called Capital Spirits, and it still exists in some form in Beijing under different ownership. But it was, I think, a fairly novel idea. I mean, over the years, many bartenders, both in China and elsewhere, have, you know, tried sticking baijiu in a cocktail and seeing what happens. So that wasn't really unique to them, but it wasn't certainly ever anything that had caught on before they started doing it. And there's not really a tradition of making cocktails in China. In China, baijiu is usually served neat at room temperature, and as you said, in mostly little shot glasses. Though there are parts of China where they use, you know, rice bowls or beer glasses and other things, but almost always you're shooting like small amounts of it.
What is the volume of the typical ones that you
The volume of those tend to be like 5 to 10 milliliters, which is about a third to a fourth of like a Western sized shot glass shot. And so it's always served neat and at room temperature, and it's always served alongside food, because the baijiu from different parts of China is really designed with flavors that are complementary to the food of that region of China, which is why in Sichuan, where the food's very spicy, you have a baijiu that's like very sweet and fruity, because it really brings down the spice in your mouth, and the spice in the food like brings out some of the more like subtle aromatics in the baijiu itself. So that's how it's mostly consumed. And then you also have like this like paojiu, or like infused alcohol tradition in China that's largely tied up with Chinese medicine, where you take fruits, herbs, spices, sometimes animals, and you soak them in the alcohol, and whatever curative properties those ingredients are supposed to have gets absorbed into the baijiu, and then you drink it as, you know, a tonic of some sort. And in many parts of China, they also just drink infused baijiu's and huangzhou's because they enjoy the flavor of them, and for nothing more mysterious than that. So while it is true that cocktails themselves aren't really a part of Chinese tradition, the notion that baijiu's flavors are meant to be paired with other flavors is very much a part of how Chinese have always viewed alcohol. That alcohol is not something that you just open a bottle and sit down and drink by itself. You always are pairing it with other things that will bring out the best in it.
Cool. Very interesting. That makes a lot of sense, actually. I'd love to hear a little bit more about the cocktails in a second. But you're partnered with Luzhou Laojiao, and they've charged you with, figuring out a baijiu that will appeal to the Western palate, so to speak. Can you describe the process of how, I guess there must be some, recipe or blending, or, how did you actually work with that? I mean, you did focus groups, tests, talked to bartenders. Love to hear how you worked on the product.
We viewed the process of taking baijiu outside of China a little bit differently, I think, than a lot of people who had made earlier attempts at creating international baijiu brands did. Because a lot of the early international baijiu brands started from the hypothesis that baijiu was too funky and out there for anyone outside of China to appreciate, that there was something wrong with baijiu itself that needed to be corrected. So they would either add flavors or they would filter the baijiu in different ways. They were trying to kind of take something of the product's essence out of it to make it, less Chinese. Whereas we started from the opposite assumption that baijiu is in and of itself a good drink that can be appreciated by people who like good drinks if it was presented to them in a way that they could appreciate and understand it. So the drink itself, we wanted to change as little as possible. We spent almost all of our efforts thinking about what the right way to introduce it into new settings was. So, like, for example, we chose the name Ming River, which references the distillery's heritage. It's a very well-known distillery located on the Yangtze River, and it's the oldest distillery in China that was founded during the Ming Dynasty. So it ties back to the distillery, but it's not Luzhou Laojiao, which is a word that's functionally unpronounceable to non-Mandarin speakers. And just, marketing 101, if you're trying to sell something, people need to be able to say it out loud and remember it for the next time they want to order it. Then we took a design that uses several traditional, Chinese design elements. And it's actually, the shape of it is based on a Chinese lantern, and it's taken from the shape of one of Luzhou Laojiao's most popular bottles from the 1980s. But we extended the neck of the bottle for a very important reason, which is if you're working with a bartender, they need to be able to grab the bottle by the neck from the well in front of them so they can use it in cocktails and make it easier to pour. And then another minor change. We have a wooden cork, which is unheard of in China, because when you're drinking baijiu at the dinner table in China, oftentimes you have to actually physically destroy the lid of the bottle in order to open it, because there's no expectation that you're going to save any of it for later. You're supposed to drink the entire bottle right then and there with your friends, and that's the end of it. But if you're not accustomed to drinking that much baijiu in one sitting, you need a bottle that you can close and go back to later. Just very, very superficial changes that respect the heritage of the product and are true to what baijiu is in China. Then I would say one final and important change that we made to the baijiu itself is that it is a unique blend that's unique to that particular product. So our distillery makes dozens of different brands in China that they sell. But each one of these products is blended. So I won't get too into it, but suffice it to say there's different grades of baijiu depending on the age and the time and the way in which the baijiu is made that they keep at their production facility. And they blend these all together using different grades of baijiu in different brands for different price points. So we went to the distillery. We knew what the selling price had to be in the U.S. if it was going to be successful. A lot of baijiu brands in the past had made a mistake by taking their best baijiu, which sells for like $200 a bottle, and thinking that that was their best product, so that's what they needed to sell overseas. But very few people are willing to gamble that kind of money on a spirit they don't know very well. So we priced it, you know, kind of in like the upper mid-range of the U.S. market at like about $35 retail, and work backwards from that. Like, we knew what our costs would be. We knew what the distributor's cut would be. We knew what the, you know, bar, restaurant, liquor store's cut would be. And so we had a price in mind on what we could spend on the liquid itself. So we told them that price. We said, give us the best baijiu blends you can make at that price point. And then we took those blends with us to New York and got together a bunch of the best known and most respected bartenders in town. And we had them taste several different blends that our blender had put together that highlighted different elements of Strong Aromas Baijiu's flavor. And so we started with four, A, B, C, and D. We got the feedback, who liked which styles the most. We took that feedback back to our blender, and she gave us four more different blends that took into account the feedback we got from the first round. We did this another couple of times until we narrowed down exactly the blend that we wound up putting inside the bottle in Ming River. So it's made exactly the same way as all of their other baijiu's, but the blend itself is one that I feel pretty confident saying is one that if you drink a lot of light aroma, or not light aroma, if you drink a lot of strong aroma baijiu, you'll recognize it and you'll appreciate it as that. It's a perfectly fine drink to consume neat alongside a spicy hot pot. But it's also something that, because we took into account feedback from bartenders, I think highlights more of like the floral element of the strong aroma baijiu profile, these like really nice kind of like star anise fennel notes that you get out of it that maybe is slightly easier to work with in a cocktail than some of their other blends. So yeah, that's how we landed with what became Ming River.
How about one, this question might not make sense, but did you think at all about the alcohol level? I mean, baijiu has such a wide range from, you know, like 30% to 60%. You know, as you mentioned, the strong aroma, the Wulong Ye, is usually like 52%. So how did you think about that? Or was that just a natural part of the blending where it was just a variable the blender took care of?
So the high strength baijiu's actually cost more to produce, but also are often subject to higher taxes when you're taking them outside of the country. So we knew that we didn't want to have the, you know, high end, the like 50%+ alcohol by volume strength. And our distillery actually, and a lot of distilleries actually bottle the same brands at different strengths. So not long ago, Moutai introduced a 45% alcohol by volume blend of Moutai, whereas 53% was their standard. And our distillery as well often bottles their products at both 52 and 38% alcohol by volume. And interestingly enough, in the town of Luzhou, where our baijiu is made, when we go out to drink with the distillery, more often than not, they're drinking the 38%. That's what they prefer out there, because I think it's easier to appreciate the flavor without having so much of a punch. But We knew that we wanted an ingredient that was going to be used in cocktails, so we didn't want to go all the way down to that strength. So we landed at 45%, which is just about right in the middle between those two strengths. And I think it works well because, as I said before, it works neat if you're, you know, drinking it with food, but it also goes pretty well in a cocktail and more than carries its weight in terms of providing a buzz.
Cool. Very interesting. So you have a product now, let's say. Can you say a little bit about the complexities of getting that product to the U.S.? I assume bars initially, you know, found bars. And I know in the U.S. that the like sales of alcohol is very complicated and how it's regulated at the state level. So just your whole distribution strategy, I'd love to hear about.
Sure. So after we had the product ready to go, we'd developed the blend. We worked with a pretty well-known bottle designer in Manchester, England, who gave us the mold for the bottle that we ended up using and designed the labels. When we had a finished product, we had to first find an importer in the U.S. because they have there what's called a three-tier system, where you have to have like a different importer, a different distributor, and a different distributor in all 50 states. You can't use the same distributor in...
Wow. Did you know that when you got started in this?
We figured this out pretty early on. And then the actual retail outlet, the interface with the customer, whether it be the liquor store or the bar or the restaurant, all three of these are, you know, legally separated in the United States. So there's a lot of complexity into it. And first we found an importer, and it was an importer that worked with primarily like smaller imported brands, and was a really good fit for us at that time. Park Street was the importer because they specialize in these kind of small imports, and as a result, they have the ability to directly distribute in a couple of markets in the U.S. So we didn't have to find new distributors in New York and California, which are our biggest and first targets in the U.S. So we were able to get started right away in those two markets once we agreed to terms with them as an importer. And from that point, it was mostly trial and error. We, at the same time we launched in the U.S., we launched in Germany with our partner, Matthias Hager, who's based in Berlin. And so he started slowly building a distribution network in Europe. And we started working with our sales network in New York and California to kind of, you know, establish a proof of concept that we could build upon. So we found accounts in these places. We started selling products. And on the strength of what we were able to do in those markets, we were able to expand into other markets, New Jersey, and then Illinois, followed by another couple smaller markets and a few like special orders to states that have alcohol monopolies like Oregon. And meanwhile, in Europe, Matthias was able to get us into Denmark and Switzerland and Austria, focusing on the immediate vicinity around Germany where he was based, but slowly but surely expanding. And then we had a really big expansion in the last 6 months, actually, where we started working with a different national sales team who also functions as our importer, which is a company called 375 Park Avenue, not to be confused with our previous importer.
It's interesting, two companies with the same similar
with
name.
Park, yeah. in the name, but 375 Park Avenue is a division of one of the largest liquor companies in the United States, Sazerac. So they actually represent a lot of different brands that are quite well known in the US market and have experience working with distributors in every state and multiple distributors in every state. So we've really undergone a pretty significant expansion in our US distribution capabilities in the last several months, where we went from being available in about 5 states to being available in more than 20 states in a matter of a few months. So that's been a huge help to us. Also because when we were building the brand over the first couple of years, we were focusing almost exclusively on restaurants, mostly like higher end Chinese restaurants and craft cocktail bars. So our efforts were focused on almost entirely what they call on-premise accounts, where only about 10% of our sales were in what were called called off-premise accounts, which are, you know, retail outlets.
Got it. How about online?
That's another good question. So when COVID happened, we had this huge problem where almost all of the people selling our Baijiu in the United States and Europe were bars and restaurants, and bars and restaurants were closing or doing only like takeaway, which isn't conducive to Baijiu cocktails for the most part. So we had to totally rethink our strategy. One of the first things we did was to address the concern you just raised, online sales, because we really, it's very difficult to sell alcohol online in the United States because it's illegal to ship alcohol over state lines. Whereas they don't have this problem in Europe, and it's pretty easy to sell alcohol online in most of the world. But in the US, you have this problem. So what we had to do if we wanted to sell is we worked out an arrangement with a third-party company that's called Cask and Barrel Club that specializes as being an intermediary company. So they actually set up an online store for Ming River where they are running it and handling all of the sales, and they work with distributors in, I think, 40-something states in the United States. So almost everywhere in the U.S., if you go to their store, shopmingriver.com, which we set up last summer, you can order Ming River, and it will be supplied by a local distributor that will ship it directly to you. So it's a very convoluted process, but it's what you have to do if you want to be operating online in the US. And the other thing that I think is very lucky for us in terms of our recent timing is that by starting to work with 375 Park Avenue and the Sazerac company, is that they have relationships with these distributors in all of these different states, and they also have a pretty strong national sales team. So they have been able very quickly, in a matter of just a few months, to get us in a lot of retail outlets that we weren't in before, to the point where just looking at the sales in recent months, our numbers are exactly flipped, where, you know, we've got 80 to 90% of our sales are now in liquor stores, and a small portion of them are in bars and restaurants. But hopefully, with the vaccination rollout, there will be more of a market for bars and restaurants by this summer, and we can get back to something that's, if not, you know, majority driven by bars and restaurants, at least closer to 50-50 and a more sustainable path forward than we had before.
Yeah, well, it's great to hear about this recent, you know, progress. I mean, even amidst COVID, and really, you know, wish you guys the best of luck as you mentioned, the vaccinations roll out and people start going out again. I mean, it seems you're, you know, very well positioned for that. A couple small final questions. I'm curious, the Baijiu cocktails, would you mind, you maybe, I don't know, what's your favorite, describing a few of those?
Sure. So I have had many, many baijiu cocktails at this point. It wasn't how I fell in love with baijiu, and I still think my favorite way to drink baijiu is alongside very spicy Chinese food in little shot glasses with my friends. But the cocktails that we found are the most successful with Ming River really fall into three approaches, which are kind of riffs on classic cocktails that add baijiu and maybe one or two other ingredients to balance it out. It works really well with like more like bitter aperitivo style drinks. So there's this one that we call the paper crane, which is a riff on the paper plane. And it uses equal parts of strong aroma baijiu, Aperol, Amaro Montenegro, and lemon juice. And it's this just nice, bitter, refreshing cocktail. It works really well in like sour style drinks, but it really, more than anything, plays really well in tiki style tropical cocktails, things like daiquiris, Mai Tais, painkillers, things that have a naturally like very like sweet, fruity flavor. Mm-hmm. The kind of drinks where you'll get them in mugs with lots of umbrellas and fruit slices sticking out of them. Really, really like a match made in heaven for strong aroma style baijiu. So
I can imagine like sitting on Hainan Island having those.
Yeah, exactly. And my favorite one of those is a drink developed by a friend of ours, Shannon Mustafer, author of Tiki, Modern Tropical Cocktails. And she put together a series of drinks for us, my favorite of which is called Trader's Treasure. So the Trader's Treasure is a really like complex layered cocktail that combines Ming River baijiu with Batavian arak, which is like a rum-like drink made in Indonesia, chinar, honey syrup, lime juice, and pineapple juice. And just, to my mind, a perfect baijiu cocktail. So I would also urge your readers, if they're interested in more baijiu cocktails, to check out on our website, mingriver.com. If you click on the button for cocktails on the menu, there's a link to download a cocktail book of our favorite cocktails that we have developed over the last couple of years that have a pretty good range and also various levels of difficulty, so that home bartenders need not be scared off. There's plenty of super simple drinks in there that will be very difficult to mess up.
Cool. I'll take a look at that myself. I haven't seen that yet. That's great. Final question. Your favorite baijiu? I mean, you can't say Ming River or any Luzhou Laojiaowen. Which do you have a favorite baijiu?
Oh, now you're going to get me in trouble with my partners.
Well, we've stipulated, you know, you can't say Ming River, because of course it's,
so
I'm sure it's Ming River.
I do want to say, and this is not me puffing up Luzhou Laojiao, but as you will see if you followed my early blogging on baijiu or read Drunken China, that it was Luzhou Laojiao's top shelf 1573 baijiu was the turning point for me, the first baijiu I fell in love with and still one of my favorites. So, but if I'm not allowed to say that, I would recommend another old famous baijiu brand from Sichuan, Jin Nanchun, which a friend of mine worked with for a while and is a really good example of the five grain style strong aroma baijiu that uses more than just sorghum. It's a slightly different flavor profile, but worth checking out if you like strong aroma baijiu as well. And then I'll give you one baijiu that I think is maybe a good baijiu to recommend to your friend who says baijiu is the worst thing that he or she has ever tried and doesn't think there's a baijiu out there that they can appreciate. And that would be a baijiu called Lao Guilin, that's made by the Guilin Sanhua Distillery, which is a rice aroma baijiu distillery. And this is a really special baijiu that's made exclusively from like sticky rice. So it's got a lot of natural sweetness to it, but it's also just this very like mellow, super delicious, like honey-like drink that I think is something you can surprise your friends with and maybe don't even tell them that you're serving them baijiu until after they try it to get their reaction, because I think it will make people reconsider what they think baijiu is and can be. So one of my favorites in the rice aroma category, and something I think is a good way to trick your friends into liking baijiu.
Great, super interesting. And I must say, you know, our conversation has really made me miss being in China. You know, with COVID, it's been over a year. And so, you know, hopefully we'll be back before not too long. So really, yeah, just want to thank you for this super interesting discussion. You know, encourage the listeners to check out your website of Ming River Baijiu, and also your book, Drunk in China, which I think is just a fantastic sort of story of a personal experience mixed with a lot of interesting history and culture. So thank you so much, Derek, for joining us on China Corner Office. Really enjoyed the discussion.
Thanks, me too. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on China Corner Office. This podcast was produced and edited by Chris Marquis, Kaiser Guo, and Jason McRonald. Did you enjoy the show? If so, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know your thoughts. And don't forget to subscribe to the feed for alerts when new episodes are published. See you soon.